You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on February 25th, 2024. And I'll read the featured story of the magazine this week. Hundreds of the world's endangered and threatened languages are spoken in and around New York City. It shows a map of Manhattan, and it has a huge list of attached to different spots in the city of all these different languages, many I've never heard of. One project set out to document them: The Endangered Languages of New York by Alex Karp. Most people think of endangered languages as far-flung or exotic, the opposite of cosmopolitan. You go to some distant mountain or island, you collect stories, the linguist Ross Perlin says, describing a typical view of how languages are studied. But of the 700 or so speakers of Saké, most of whom can be found in a cluster of villages in Nepal, more than 150 have lived in and around two apartment buildings in Brooklyn, Bishnupriya, Manipuri, a minority language of Bangladesh and India, has become a minority language of Queens. All told, there are more endangered languages in and around New York City than have ever existed anywhere else, says Perlin, who has spent 11 years trying to document them and became one of the world's languages. And because most of the world's languages are a path to disappear within the next century, there will likely never be this many in a single place again. Language loss has been a natural part of human history for centuries, but it was typically small in scale and relatively confined. The lost language could sometimes leave traces in the language that overtook it, what linguists have called a grammatical merger of intersecting societies. About 30 years ago, though, the linguists Ken Hale and Michael Krauss warned of a new, more dire form of loss in which a dominant language would simply overwhelm indigenous local languages and cultures. Hundreds of languages were essentially gone, Krauss noted, and others were quickly fading. Several were spoken by as few as one or two people. As Perlin writes in his new book, Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues in New York City, out this month, what stands to be lost is more than mere words. Languages represent thousands of natural experiments, ways of seeing, understanding, and living that should rightly form a major part of any meaningful account of what it is to be human. With Daniel Kaufman, also a linguist, Perlin directs the Endangered Language Alliance in Manhattan. When ELA was founded, 2010, Perlin lived in the Chinese Himalayas, where he studied Trung, a language with no standard writing system, dictionary, or codified grammar. His work helped establish all three. He spent most of his time in the valley where the largest group of remaining speakers lived. The only road in or out was impassable in winter. After 3 years, Perlin returned to New York City, where he had grown up. At the time, ELA conducted language surveys on foot, canvassing neighborhoods and posting flyers seeking speakers of endangered languages. Most of the work was directed by the organization's founders, two linguists, including Kaufman and a poet. 2016, ELA began to map the languages spoken in the city. A vast majority were not recognized by large businesses, schools, or city government. Officially, Perlin said, they were simply not there. None of the communities, Perlin said, they were simply none of the communities with whom we planned to partner were recorded as even existing in the census, Kaufman and Perlin later wrote. Since their project began, Perlin and Kaufman have located speakers of more than 700 languages. Of those languages, at least 150 are listed as under significant threat and at least one of the three major databases for the field. Perlin and Kaufman consider that figure to be conservative, And Perlin estimates that more than half of the languages they documented may be endangered. Among the endangered languages shown here is Seki, a language from Nepal that has only 700 or so global speakers. That's located on a map in Queens. A language's endangerment is not simply a function of its size, but also a measure of its relationship to the societies around it. Sheer numbers have always mattered less than intergenerational transmission, Perlin writes in Language City. Till recently, many regions of the world, dozens of languages lived side by side, with each no more than a few thousand speakers. Gurgoni, an Aboriginal Australian language, has long been stable with 70. A language survives, Perlin writes, by sharing life with those who speak it. Only in the face of intense political, economic, religious, or social pressures do people stop passing on their mother tongues to children. When Perlin visited Seke-speaking Nepali villages in 2019 and 2023, he found that many of the people he wanted to speak with had left to find work. Whole age groups were missing, he says. Kaufman points to Mixtec, a group of indigenous languages spoken in south central Mexico with 500,000 speakers. The difference in how the language is spoken from village to village can be bigger than you find between French and Italian, he said. And there are villages where there are essentially no young people. Their children are now born elsewhere. Culiacan, Mexico, New York, Los Angeles, 500,000 speakers can disappear in a generation. I'm skipping over some of the maps. Perlin studies languages for what they communicate, both explicitly and indirectly. A language lexicon is not just one word after another, he writes in Language City, but a representation of the enduring preoccupations of a culture. Its rules of grammar are held together by invisible selections of what will be conveyed and what will be overlooked. It requires speakers to mark out certain parts of reality and not others, however unconsciously. When Perlin and Kaufman document a language, they work alongside native speakers to transcribe and translate video interviews that are recorded locally and during trips to a language's home region. Perlin and Kaufman have helped produce some of the first dictionaries and grammars of these languages. To document Seke, for example, Perlin works with Rasmina Gurung, a 26-year-old nurse who happens to be one of the youngest Seke speakers in the world. Most Seke speakers, about 500 people, live across five neighboring villages in northern Nepal near Tibet. Though the villages are within walking distance, each has developed its own Seke dialect. Like many of the smaller languages of traditional face-to-face societies, Perlin writes, Seke has no formal all-purpose hello because villagers live among the same groups of people and rarely encounter a Seke-speaking stranger. Instead, a question, where are you going? What are you doing? Would be more common. When ELA researchers travel to interview speakers in their home regions, they may begin with a list of common questions, but the conversations are often more freeform. Whatever the speakers want to talk about the most, we always encourage that. Gurung says, we always want to understand the language better, but we need to understand where it came from, how it came to be, whatever's close to home. As ELA produced its first language maps, the Institute's work caught the eye of Thelma Carrillo, a research scientist in the city's health department. Carrillo is part Zapotec, was working on a Latino health initiative, but the city had what Perlin and Kaufman found to be no basic demographic information on New Yorkers from indigenous communities in Latin America even though they have been migrating here in large numbers since the 1900s. We found ourselves in this odd position of being a conduit between the indigenous Latin Americans of the city and the city agencies, because other organizations that work with them see them as Mexican or Guatemalan, Kaufman says. We're working with their languages, which becomes extremely important when you need to communicate something to them. By the start of the pandemic, the city had begun official outreach in 9 indigenous languages and recorded videos in several other endangered languages. By reaching these communities in their own languages, New York City offered what is most certainly the first official recognition that they exist. Still, Perlin and Kaufman are keenly aware that the corpus they are building, word by word, and sometimes syllable by syllable, might someday turn out to be kind of fossil record. Outside of the office, Guru mostly speaks Seke in voice notes to elders overseas or to tell her mother a secret she doesn't want her sister to hear. On her first trip to Nepal with ELA, she ended up every interview with the same question. Do you think our language will survive? Here's samples of some of the languages. Now I'll read the talk section of the magazine. What it's like to be a sociopath. There's a picture of a woman. She's got a nice smile, red lips. She looks like she's in her 30s maybe. And she's interviewed as usual by David Marchese. Sociopaths are modern day boogeymen. And the word sociopath is casually tossed around to describe the worst, most amoral among us. But they're not boogeymen. They're real people, and according to Patrick Gagné, widely misunderstood. Gagné wrote Sociopath, her buzzy forthcoming memoir, to try to correct some of those misunderstandings and provide a fuller picture of sociopathy, which is now more frequently referred to as antisocial personality disorder. As a child, Gagné found herself compelled toward violent outbursts in an effort to try to compensate for the emotional apathy, which was her default. As she got older, those compulsive behaviors turned into criminal ones like trespassing and theft. Eventually, she discovered there was a name, that dreaded word, that could be used to describe and explain her experiences of remorselessness, criminality, and lack of empathy. The desire to destigmatize her experience and also to help others who may share it. Gagné previously worked as a therapist to those with the disorder and has also written about sociopathy, put Gagné on a path that led to sociopath. I'm not trying to say sometimes we do bad things, but we're really sweet on the inside, says Gagné, who's 48. I'm saying there is more to this personality type. And David asks, when I hear the word sociopath, I think of an antisocial, uncaring person who is interested only in satisfying his or her own desires. What's a clearer picture? Sociopathy is a perilous mental disorder. The traits associated with sociopathy aren't great, but that only tells part of the story. The part that's missing is you can be a sociopath and have a healthy relationship. You can be a sociopath and be educated. That's a very uncomfortable reality for some people. People want to believe that all sociopaths are monsters and that all monsters are easy to spot. David, in the book, you write about stabbing a classmate with a pencil when you were a kid, and then as you got older, trespassing and stealing cars. You don't succumb to those sociopathic compulsions anymore. How did you learn to control those urges? As a kid, I didn't understand why I was acting out the way I was. All I knew was I felt this pressure, and something in my brain was telling me, punch that kid, and you'll feel better. As I got older, I understood, okay, there's a name for this. There's a whole group of people who share this diagnosis. Once I understood that I wasn't out in space, untethered and going crazy, I was on the path to understanding that when I had those feelings of go steal a car, I could do that, but now I understand what's going on. That understanding helped break the cycle, or at least redirect the compulsion towards something less destructive. What does that redirecting look like in practice? Every once in a while, I will have an urge to do something destructive just because I can. And my redirect is, do you want this destructive behavior? Or do you want to continue to maintain this life that you have, which requires that you do not do those things? I have to have that conversation with myself. That's a recent sociopathic impulse that you had. This is a very vanilla example. When I go to the grocery store and I come home, if anything that I've purchased has gone bad, I'll make a mental note. I'm stealing this next time. You write about your difficulty with understanding other people's emotions, feeling apathy and lacking empathy. But you also write about experiencing love. Why are you innately able to feel love but not, say, empathy? The way I experience love seems to be very different from the so-called neurotypical experience. My experience of love seems less emotional. If I had to explain what love feels like to me, I would say symbiotic. So a relationship that's beneficial to both people involved, not transactional, not possessive, not ego-driven, mutual homeostasis. It's not that I'm unable to access emotions or empathy. It's that my experience of those emotions is different. When you write about becoming a mom, you say that profound feelings of love toward your child were non-intrinsic, and you had to work to experience them. Can you tell me about that work? As a woman, forget my personality type, you're inundated with all these images. Your child is born. It's incredible. I didn't experience that. I didn't have that immediate baby is born, I'm overwhelmed with love. It was, I don't know this person. This person is very loud. That connection just isn't there. It's not innate. But over time, you can build it. Much like when I first met David. I knew right away that this person was going to be important in my life, but I didn't have those sweeping, romantic, flowery emotions affiliated with that experience. That was the same way when I first met my son. Now I think he's a great kid. Are you able to describe how you've built a sense of morality? Just because I don't care about someone else's pains, so to speak, doesn't mean I want to cause more of it. I enjoy living in this society. I understand that there are rules. I choose to follow those rules because I understand the benefits of this world, this house where I get to live, this relationship I get to have. That's different from people who follow the rules because they have to. They should. They want to be a good person. None of those apply to me. I want to live in a world where things function properly. If I create messes, my life will become messy. I think people are uncomfortable with the idea of, you don't really care? What does it matter? Why does it matter why I choose to help the woman across the street? Why does it matter why I choose to pick up a wallet and hand it to the person in as opposed to keeping it? It's not because I'm a good person. It's not because I would feel shame or guilt. But why does that matter? What advice do you have for neurotypical people about how best to interact with someone who identifies as sociopathic? I'm not sure neurotypicals need any because I've been identifying as a sociopath for years now, and my experience with people who don't know that has been positive. I've yet to encounter anybody when I disclose my diagnosis acts afraid or upset. I think inherently neurotypicals are fascinated by sociopathy because it's a relatable disorder. Everybody has that darkness in them. Everybody has those thoughts that they shoo away because of guilt. If more conversations between neurotypical and so-called neurodivergence were to occur, it would benefit both. It would benefit the sociopathic person because that acceptance lets 80% of the air out of the balloon. But it would help the neurotypicals like, oh, I can share things with this person that maybe I couldn't share with other people. I get more secrets from strangers after telling them my diagnosis. You wouldn't believe the things that people have told me because they feel safe. What secrets did they tell you? Oh, man, I was sitting across from a man at a dinner party. This was like 2 years ago. And my diagnosis came up. And 30 seconds afterward, he said, you know, I have thoughts of killing my wife a lot. not to normalize that, but I was like, tell me about that. And he goes, I've really thought about it. I've reached out to people about hiring somebody to kill her. So people just assume that you're a sympathetic audience? Yeah, because they are things you're not supposed to think about. So to be able to talk to somebody, you don't have to worry that I'm going to start clutching my pearls. You are a practicing therapist, and we think of therapists as highly empathic, invested in the emotions and stories of their clients. So how did you relate to your clients? I didn't relate to them. Now, that is not to say I didn't care about my patients. The easy answer is, of course, I care about you. I wouldn't continue to see you if I didn't. But why do you need that reassurance from me? My job is to help you understand what's going on with you. My job is to help you take your emotions, separate them out, explore your motivation. That's my job. I think that I was a good therapist because I was able to parse those things out unemotionally. My gift to my therapy patients was that I was able to lend them sociopathy. Why do you care? What does it matter? What do you need from that? That, I felt, helped them achieve things that maybe a non-sociopathic therapist couldn't have offered. In the book, you describe things like mirroring people back to themselves or your conscious and intentional manipulation in the moment. Is that happening now? Listen, everyone has a front-facing persona. Most people use that persona as a preference, a desire to be liked, fear of judgment, wanting someone to be friends with them. But sociopaths use it out of necessity, and that's a really important distinction. My decision to mask is not because I have some dark, ulterior motive. It's because you guys are interesting to me. Neurotypical emotions are so colorful and complex. In order for me to engage with you, you have to feel comfortable with me. In order for you to feel comfortable with me, I have to mask. I find that people are unnerved by me when I'm not masking, because otherwise I'm quiet. I ask invasive questions. I stare. My affect is low. The bottom line is that I want you to feel comfortable, so I engage. I smile. I mirror. It's not nefarious. It's necessary. The issue here is motivation. I don't mask because I'm secretly trying to kill you. I mask because I want you to feel comfortable because I find you interesting. What's an invasive question you want to ask me? Why are you interested in me? Why are you interested in sociopathy? Talk to me about your darkness. I'm not expecting answers. You want to get into it? Oh, yes, I find neurotypical people absolutely delightful. I'll give you two reasons I'm interested. I was sent the book and I started reading, and the opening involved you as a second grader stabbing a kid in the head with a pencil. I thought, holy moly, readers will be interested in this. So there was a mercenary quality to my own interest. Then also there are times when I've wondered if the skills that I've learned from doing my job over the years are basically just forms of interpersonal manipulation. And I was curious to talk to you as a roundabout way of exploring that question for myself. Where does that question reach you? What do you mean? Do you manipulate people in order to execute your job? I think there's a degree of manipulation, but what do we really mean by manipulation? Is manipulation a definition, by definition, negative? Or does manipulation just mean intentionally creating a certain interpersonal context? She says, that sounds like a justification to me, which means you're sidestepping shame or sidestepping guilt. I disagree, David. That would be like saying therapists are always guilty of manipulation. And she says, so we're clear, when I said justification, I wasn't trying to say that what you were doing was bad. You're talking to a sociopath. I don't think anything that you're doing is bad. Yes, you are manipulating people to a certain extent, to your point, in the way that I might manipulate somebody in therapy. But I would never feel the need to justify it. And your justification came so quickly. That's why I was like, hey, what's happening that you felt the need to defend your answer? We don't usually say we have to justify a positive thing, David says. That's probably why I reacted that way. What else? She says, how much of that dark side of sociopathy can you relate to? And if you don't have an easy answer for that, was it comforting to read about somebody who was open with their experience of being fully immersed in their darkest impulses and a lot of times carrying them out? David, well, I would say that one question that the book raised for me was the extent to which a lot of behaviors that people do could be considered sociopathic, and we just don't understand them that way. Plenty of us do things that we know are bad because the transgressions feel good. And she says, it feels good. Why? I think it feels good because it feels free. To do something bad, it's like, I don't give a expletive. The consequences, be it internal guilt, or getting thrown in jail, happen after. In this moment, I'm going to do this because it feels expletive great to just not care. That's what the sociopath experience is almost all the time. One piece of advice I would give to anyone who sees themselves in my description is to find an external philosophy that works for you. I like karma. Seems clean. Seems organized. Find that philosophy for yourself because you're not going to get to rely on internal checks and balances. I realize I don't quite understand what you meant when you said that you can experience empathy just differently. What is empathy to you? Eventually, as I got older, what I started to realize is that if I can connect to something that I can internalize naturally, I use that as a bridge to broaden my empathic response. For example, I found frequently that a lot of people who exhibit sociopathic symptoms have strong feelings for pets. That's a great bridge. You would feel upset if something happened to this animal that you care about. Now let's extend that feeling to someone close to you that you have a strong relationship with. And David says, and when you say extend that feeling, is it cognitive understanding that you're describing or an emotional response? At first it's cognitive, then over time that does grow into the emotion. It's the understanding of what that leads to the feeling. I'm sure you've had a situation where someone is explaining something to you and at first you're like, I don't care. David, multiple times a day, he laughs. She says, great, now imagine if that's your first instinct, but you understand that you have to be like, oh yeah, I understand that I have to care. That is cognitive empathy. You're not faking it, but you're internalizing it. That you, your first take on something, and then maybe you get to know the situation better, you find something about that situation that you can anchor to, and then the feeling kicks in. Do you see your sociopathy as beneficial to you? I think my sociopathy is entirely beneficial to me. I see my friends struggling with guilt. On an almost daily basis, I think, I'm glad I don't have that. The psychological characteristics of sociopathy are not inherently bad. Lack of remorse, shame, and guilt has been misappropriated to mean this horrible thing. But again, just because I don't care about you doesn't mean I want to cause you more pain. I like that I don't have guilt because I'm making my decisions based on logic, based on truth, as opposed to ought or should. Now there's a flip side. I don't have those natural emotional connections to other people, but I've never had those. I don't feel like I'm missing anything. Just because I love differently doesn't mean my love doesn't count. Now I'll read the Screenland section of the magazine. Teen subcultures are fading. Pity the poor kids. Gorgeous, abundant visuals are just pale imitations of what young people used to have. An actual scene. This is a story by Mirelle Silkoff. A few years ago, my 12-year-old daughter showed me a video created by a Dallas clothing store called Dear Hannah Prep, depicting a girl's first time visiting the preppiest boutique in Texas. How excited are you? An off-camera voice asks. I'm so excited, the girl said. Then she opens the door, gasps, and declares, it's so preppy in here that this moment has become a meme, spawning an array of other videos riffing on the original. We see the girl enter a derelict classroom or padded cell and swoon each time, that it's so preppy in here was far less confusing to me than the fact that people were calling this store an all-white box exploding with smiley face sweater shirts and tie-dyed fuzzy bathrobes and a generally berserk neon beachiness preppy. That, I told my daughter, is not preppy. I didn't have much hope of persuading her that millions of teenagers on TikTok were wrong about her and her 50-year-old mother, who does in fact own a copy of Lisa Birnbach's 1980, The Official Preppy Handbook, was right, but it seemed worth trying. I looked around her room, and for lack of any stray loafers or rumpled chinos to use as examples, I touched the top of an antique oak dresser that was once her grandmother's. "This is preppy," I said. She rolled her eyes. "Mom, that dresser is super cottagecore, and that is not my aesthetic at all." My daughter's preppy is not my idea of preppy. The prep of actual New England prep schools, of frayed Oxford cloth and waspy noblesse oblige. Nor is it the aspirational varsity style of Tommy Hilfiger and 1990s rappers in rugby shirts, or even J. Crew's self-conscious 2010s update on old money style. Those meanings haven't vanished. A great deal has been written about them lately, much of it connected to Avery Trufelman's erudite series American Ivy, released on her broadcast in 2022. But those iterations are now known in the TikTok world as old preppy. The new sort fills its Pinterest pages with something else. Colorful Stanley mugs, tiered pink micro minis, bulbed makeup mirrors, and Brazilian bum-bum creams. Part of which makes it hard to describe is that it is not rooted in any specific culture. It seems to be largely about being fun and a girl and buying things packaged with a bright color on a white background. There's no deep ethos to it, no shared experience, other than posting videos of shopping hauls or makeup routines, pastimes usually engaged in alone or in your bedroom. This is not just true of preppy. If you're a teenager or have exposure to teenagers, what I'm about to write is something you probably know already. Subcultures in general, once the poles of style and art and politics and music, around which wound so many ribbons of teenage meaning, have largely collapsed. What teenagers today are offered instead is a hyperactive landscape of so-called aesthetics, thousands of them, including everything from the infamous cottagecore to these days prep. These are more like cultural atmospheres, performed mainly online with names and looks and hashtags and easy visual pablum. They come and go and blend and break apart like clouds in the wind, many within weeks of appearing. They have much content, but little context. A lot to look at, but a very thin relationship to any real life anything, like behaviors or gathering places. On one end, there's a distinctly in-the-world subculture, like, say, grunge, can be reduced to a vibe packet of anodyne references, cigarettes, grimy things. On the other, a mere mood tone can be elevated to something offering as lifestyle. There are girls who enjoy the color red and a certain Euro effortlessness, and they're called tomato girls, while others who prefer white are called vanilla girls. If 24 things on a Pinterest page feel as if they go together, chances are someone, even just as a lark or experiment, is calling it an aesthetic. For proof, you need only to log on to Aesthetics Wiki, a wonderfully encyclopedic website for online style tribes. Here you will find not only large categories of emo, Y2K, VSCO, academia, or the perennial goth, but also categories so specific that their nicheness begins feeling like an Escher staircase of references. The roughly 200 aesthetics found under the randomly chosen letter M contains something that will be legible to many: Memphis rap, mod, some that involve a kind of style-sensitive hair-splitting, mall goth, messy French it girl, McBling, and others that are just full-on WTF. Meatcore is for people who appreciate raw meat as a non-dietary object. On monumentality, and monumentality is the appreciation of anything big, like a Godzilla, Gothic cathedrals, giant redwoods, or asteroids. Many asteroids are fairly large, they say. It's hard to imagine a monumentality meetup because, like so many aesthetics, monumentality is only referential. It's conversation ending right where it begins. Do you like big things? Yes, because it's big. As with much of today's culture, say ASMR, hair brushing, or pimple popping videos, the level of specificity and intimate itch scratching here feels like a lot like porn, another extension of the internet's ability to service niche desires. And in terms of their enhancement of human experience, many aesthetics seem to offer about as much as porn does, a fleeting personal pleasure to be had mainly alone. Yet when I look at the younger people in my life, the teenagers crate digging through these details, arguing about dark academia versus light academia, or the difference between goblin core and crow core, doesn't seem to me that they want to negate meaning. It seems as they are looking hard for identity, for validation, for the dignification of their taste. It's just that they are being presented with these thin cultural planes that barely exist outside their devices. To me, this is tragic, and I feel annoyed on their behalf. So I will risk something sounding like an old raver shaking her cane to note that subcultures, even the vapid ones, used to tie their participants to people and places. Getting into a scene could be work. It required figuring out whom to talk to, where to go, maybe hanging awkwardly around a record store or nightclub or street corner until you got scooped up by whatever was happening. But at its deepest, a subculture could allow a given club kid, headbanger, or punk, to live in a communal container from the moment she woke up to the moment she went to bed. If you were, say, a suburban California skate rat, 1990, skating affected almost everything you did, how you spoke, the way you dressed, the people you hung out with, the places you went, the issues you cared about, the shape of your very body. And while that might not have seemed a promising plan for teenage well-being at the time, by today's standards of diffuse loneliness and alienation among youth, it looks like a very good recipe indeed. Precisely the kind of real-world cultural community that has been replaced by an algorithmic fluidity in which nothing hangs around long enough to grow roots. Kids are not failing by wanting to be cottage core or meat core or this new preppy. It's the culture available to them that is failing by no longer being able to connect any of these categories with lived experience or social meaning. Kids in all their blousy creativity, the same creativity that invented moments from romanticism to hippiedom to hip-hop, need more, deserve more. It's hard to think otherwise when looking at the aesthetics wiki entry for peoplehood. So, quote, an aesthetic revolving around common acts of kindness and intimacy that are present in daily life. It might be time to start thinking of 20th century parents' problems as solutions. The kids belong at the rave, at the block party, in the mosh pit, loitering in the park at midnight. Now I'll read from the Well section of the magazine. You're never too old for story time. Why adults should read aloud to one another, and a few recommendations to get you started. It's a story by Jancy Dunn. A few years ago, my youngest sister, Heather, had a month-long stretch of migraines. She usually managed to get through her day as a teacher, but at night she would retreat to a dark room so the light wouldn't worsen her headaches. To distract her from anxiety and pain, I offered to read aloud to her at speakerphone while she closed her eyes. Every evening until her migraines finally receded, I'd pick something, short story from Jane Gardam, an essay from Samantha Irby. Heather said my voice was soothing and reminded her of our childhood when I read her stories, and our five-year age difference seemed a lot wider. I found that I look forward to adult story time as much as Heather did. When we think of reading aloud, we often associate it with kids, said Kate DeCamillo, the author of Because of Winn-Dixie, which won the Newbery Medal for children's books and the upcoming Ferris. But grown-ups need to hear stories spoken aloud too, she said. At book events, DeCamillo urges audiences to read to other adults. It's an act of love to read to somebody, DeCamillo told me. You feel cocooned almost. It's kind of like everybody puts down their defenses and you're together in a story. Many of us learn to enjoy being read to as children, under the crook of an arm where ideal reading begins, says Marianne Wolfe, a researcher, scholar at UCLA School of Education and Information Studies, and the author of Reader, Come Home, The Reading Brain in the Digital World. In adulthood, we may not put each other under a physical crook of an arm, but we put each other under an emotional crook of the arm, Dr. Wolfe said. And research suggests the act of reading aloud may benefit the reader, too. It may improve memory, cognitive function, focus, and mood. But sometimes adults have fallen out of practice, Dr. Wolfe said. Here's how to ease into it. Start with something short. Pick a person that you're comfortable around, DeCamillo suggests, and begin with a brief passage like an essay or a poem. She recommended any volume from the anthology Poem a Day, a wide range of classic and modern poems. If you're ready to start short stories, Binocular Vision, a collection by Edith Perlman, is spectacular to read out loud, DeCamillo said. She also recommended Peace Like a River, a chapter book by Leif Enger. Find any opportunity to read. You can read a passage to your partner before bed, DeCamillo said, or to your family during breakfast. So every morning, the book's right there on the kitchen table. Everybody's in the kitchen, and you just read a chapter. Bring along a book when you're visiting someone in the hospital or at a nursing home, she said. If that person is in pain or having difficulty concentrating, she added, try children's literature. Focus on your connection rather than getting every word right. Typically, Dr. Wolfe said, we think about reading as this cognitive and linguistic activity. But it also activates empathic areas in our brain that trigger our ability to go beyond ourselves and to reach into the thoughts and feelings of others, she said. In the act of reading, she added, we are transmitting emotions. We are transmitting affection. And while reading aloud can make some of us feel self-conscious, DeCamillo said to remind yourself, this is not a test, so don't worry about nailing every word. Reading aloud, she said, is a profound way to connect with somebody. You're offering yourself, she said. Doesn't have to be perfect. Need more inspiration? I asked two novelists for their favorite selections to read aloud. Maurice Carlos Ruffin, author of the upcoming The American Daughters, chose Disha Filia's short story, Peach Cobbler, which appears in her collection, The Secret Lives of Church Ladies. Filia is our reigning modern master of the short story, Ruffin said. Celeste Ng, the author of Our Missing Hearts, recommended Howl's Moving Castle by Diana Wynne Jones. When I learned my husband had never even heard of one of my favorite books from childhood, I dug up my old copy, Ning says. For a week, we took turns reading it to each other, and I'm happy to say it holds up beautifully. I'll read The Ethicist. I hate kids. Do I have to make nice with my nephew? The magazine's ethicist columnist on how to manage relationships with loved ones you don't really like. The ethicist is Kwame Anthony Appiah. And the reader writes, my only sibling is an exhausted single parent of one son. I've always disliked being around children, and no, I never want any of my own or near me. I feel pressure from my sibling and family to form a relationship with the child. I've been directly asked to entertain or spend time with them, despite my lack of interest or ease in doing so. It's unclear to me if the idea is to have me serve as a convenient babysitter, or if it's emotionally important to my sibling that, as an aunt, I be closer to my nephew. I am not close to my extended family. Besides, I'm not my nephew's only extended family. He has other aunts, along with uncles, grandparents, and cousins, whom he sees with relative frequency. I feel guilty for not wanting to try and don't want to hurt his feelings or my siblings by being absent or apathetic. What's my obligation to be a present family member when I didn't choose to be in this role? We can choose which adult relationships to maintain, including family, once we're adults, but how much can we choose to engage with the kids within it? The name was withheld. From the ethicist, I'm sure there are plenty of people who don't much enjoy spending time with children, but you may be an outlier. When you say that you never want children near you, you're describing something that sounds like a phobia more like a phobia than a preference. And I don't see how your nephew is going to benefit from hanging out with someone who regards him with all the loving kindness an arachnophobe has for a spider. Our relationships can come with special duties, such as the duty of care parents have to their offspring. For most Western families, though, the role that your siblings play in the lives of your children is effectively up for negotiation. A relationship becomes mutually established, and expectations flow from the nature of that relationship. If it's to have ethical purchase, the relationship has to have value for you. Instead, one imagines you seated bolt upright on the sofa, a sickly forced smile scarcely concealing your upwelling dread, as you pray that the little crumb-cheeked agent of chaos doesn't put his sticky hands anywhere near you. Although I suspect children generally do best if they have developed relationships with adults other than their parents, you're not the only such adult in your nephew's life. Can you just pantomime being a loving aunt? I grant that sometimes it's advisable to go through the motions when your heart isn't in it. But fond family feelings are hard to fake. Your nephew may well be better off with an absentee aunt than an aloof one. What your sibling wants is what it's normal for parents to want of those they love, that they should get to know their children. It may be painful for your sibling to discover that you genuinely don't see the point of spending time with this child. If your sibling does want help with child rearing, she could reasonably feel that you'd let her down and your relationship could be damaged. Still, if you're not cut out for sharing space with the kid, let alone helping care for him, you should be frank about it. A relationship forged only out of duty would be a joyless thing. One day, your nephew will be an adult, and he might even turn out to be someone you would like to know. But by then, of course, he would have the option of choosing not to spend time with you. And I'll end today with Judge John Hodgman on the Mother's Day pie in the face. Dad likes it a little too much. Jessica writes, 1 year my husband bought a cherry pie for me on Mother's Day, despite knowing that I don't believe in desserts that aren't chocolate. So I pied him in the face with it. This became a yearly event until he started enjoying it too much. Now I refuse to pie him, but he and the kids really want me to. And the judge writes, it's settled law in my fake court that if it's not fun for everyone, it's no fun at all. Shoving a pie in someone's face is assault, and you should not do it unless you are certain your partner is into it. Unfortunately, turns out your husband is really into that pie, and he has unfairly transformed your revenge into his kink. So throw this in his face. You have no obligation to play his sick game anymore, no matter what your kids say. They can save up their money, get their own shoving pie for Dad. You can eat chocolate and watch. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.